Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now, on to the podcast.
Hey, guys. It's been a really eventful 2 weeks. We've kind of had a longer time in between podcasts than we would have hoped for, and that's because our life has been a little hectic.
It's been a whirlwind of things. Ever since we finished the last podcast this moment, it has been nothing but a whirlwind of events happening in our life. So it's been it has been a crazy 2 weeks, and you know, we want to share that with you guys and all that happened. We'll start out, I guess, the day after we did our last podcast is a Sunday morning. And Sunday mornings are my designated morning to get up and have the kids and so that Melissa can sleep in really late. And I take care of the kids while that's happening. And I went up to get Sadie and I had on wool socks. And as I'm coming down the stairs with her and holding her in one hand and not holding the railing with the other,
first mistake.
I slipped on the stairs and my elbow went straight into the wood and I had a puncture wound on my elbow.
It honestly looked like something that you fell on something like,
right. It looked like I fell on a toy or something like that.
Yeah, like a rock had gone into his.
But pretty much my elbow just went through my skin, and yeah. And I had like a dime sized hole on my elbow, and it was funny. Like at first, I was just like, oh, you know, like I thought my elbow just hurt really bad.
Yeah, and I just thought, oh, his elbow is probably bruised.
Yeah, and Sadie had like a little cut on her face, but she was otherwise unscathed. But
she was crying, I think, because she was scared. Not so much. She did get hurt, but it wasn't like anything too bad.
Right, and so I'm just thinking my elbow's hurting, and then I just like, and then blood starts coming through my, you know, all my clothes. I was wearing a long sleeve shirt, and it starts coming through. I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm actually bleeding. And then I went and go look at it, and I can like literally see my ligaments underneath.
Yeah,
my skin.
So I thought it was like his bone, and I was like, Garrett, I'm pretty sure I can see your bone. And he looked, and he was like, nah. And then he goes, oh wait. Maybe you can.
I can move my skin around.
He was moving the skin on the outside around, and the inside was like staying still.
and then Melissa starts dry heaving.
Oh, I almost forgot about that. Yeah, I thought I had a pretty good stomach. I mean, I feel like I've.
I thought you did too, and then you start like.
So I get hot. I feel like I'm about to pass out. I'm dry heaving at the toilet because I just have seen the grossest thing that is his elbow, and I was like, I need to lay down.
Yeah.
And but anyway, so he needed stitches. He needed because I mean, yeah, you really could see ligaments. That's not being exaggerating.
No, it wasn't. I had to go get stitches that morning, and like by 10 o'clock that morning, I was done getting stitches.
Yeah. So on my morning off, I ended up having both kids almost passing out and throwing up from the sight of his wound.
So that's the way the day started.
Yeah.
And then what we had touched on before of like just thoughts of moving and things like that. We went right after that, we went to go look at a house, that was going up for sale or whatever, but hadn't been listed yet or anything in the neighborhood we were trying to get into. and went to go look at it. And basically, the way the housing market is and stuff right now, if you want a house, you got to go after it, and you got to go put an offer on it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went and looked at it and really liked it, and put an offer in on a house, and it was accepted. And so we went from stitches to all of a sudden we're buying a new house, which we hadn't really planned on. That wasn't really something that we were thinking about necessarily.
It was literally,
until the end of that.
It was literally like the week of before we had done the last podcast was when it came up. And so it's a big change, and it's a very fast change, but we're excited about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good thing.
And we'll talk some more about like the transition aspects of it, but I'm trying to give you like all the things that have happened. So then we are buying this house and getting everything set up for that. And then Melissa starts showing symptoms for COVID like that Wednesday or something.
Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And so you start coming down with COVID. We're pretty sure that it's COVID. You ended up testing negative for COVID.
Yep. So we thought, oh, okay, well, maybe it was just, I don't know.
Which I'm not a very empathetic person for sicknesses. So
yeah, he's not.
Both for myself and for others, I'm just I'm just like a big doubter of any time somebody
you're like,
is like,
you're not really sick. And I'm like, yeah, I think I am.
Yeah. And so then, I probably wasn't the nicest person that I could be. But anyways, you were showing symptoms for
it. I was showing symptoms, but I tested negative and I was feeling better. So I was like, okay, maybe it really is negative. So we go on living our life, and Caleb's birthday was coming up and everything. And I guess it was the morning of Caleb's birthday, which was Monday, I woke up and I couldn't smell anything.
Yeah.
I couldn't smell Sadie's poopy diaper, which usually that's been like my joke this whole time during COVID of like, yep, I can still smell her diaper, so I don't have COVID. Ha ha ha. Joke's on me, because I couldn't smell them at all. And I couldn't smell like my soap, shampoo in the shower, stuff like that, that I normally
And I'm
smell.
Still sitting here doubting her.
He's still like, I don't believe that
you
can't smell.
No, I don't believe that you can't smell. It's the whole remote thing. You know, like the person that you trust.
Oh, yeah.
The person that you, like, love the most in this world.
Love and trust the most in this world, but I'm still going to need evidence that you're not sitting on the remote on
the
couch.
Yeah, exactly.
The TV remote.
So it's kind of like that. It's like, yeah, you're the person that I trust the most, but whenever you tell me you're not sitting on the remote, I'm like, you're definitely on the, you know, like, you get out of the way.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
on the remote. But so
I was
the
like,
same thing with
I was
this.
Like testing things that are usually pretty strong smells to me, like hand sanitizer, couldn't smell it. And it was just like really bizarre. And so I was like, I think I got to go get tested again. And so I got tested again. Of course, it came back positive. It was like, on Caleb's birthday that afternoon that I find out I'm positive, which I knew already, because the smell and everything was just like, it's COVID.
Yeah.
But at that point, I was like already halfway into what would have been like my 10-day quarantine, because it starts with your symptoms. So we just decided, hey, let's just not isolate me, because you guys have already been around me and...
We had already been around you for 4 days with symptoms.
Damage is probably done if y'all are going to get it. So, the day that my quarantine ended, which is today, well, today was my first day of freedom. Yesterday was my last day of quarantine. And, Garrett starts running a temperature.
Yeah. Well, I started feeling, fever. I was like, something just doesn't feel right. You know, my legs feel kind of tired or whatever. And I was like, I was like convinced, no, this is just because I've been sitting at the desk all day working, and so...
So I told him, even that, I was like, go for a run, go walk or something.
And so you'd about like 4:30 or 5, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go do a run. I'm going to go run about 3 miles or so, and I do it at a really good pace. And then after that, it was just downhill, and I started feeling, you know, like head started hurting really bad, and... then I ran a fever last night, and so I actively have COVID right now.
Well,
so
yeah, I mean, you do. We haven't gotten the test result back.
We haven't gotten the test result back, so there's no proof of that.
There's no proof. And you could just be a big baby.
Yeah,
we don't know.
That's true. But with the fact that you had it, and we've been around it, and I ran a fever, and so it's probably it, and so... But you don't see me whining about it.
Oh, please. Oh, please. Well, this has just all been really challenging, the move and COVID, with just like, okay, now we got to put our house on the market, and the stress of having COVID and, you know, people being like needing to come and take pictures of our house so that we can, you know, get it out.
Right.
Get it out
there. Yeah. You're trying to organize with a real estate agent who you don't want to get COVID, you know,
you don't want to
give him COVID, kill his grandma or anything like that. Exactly. And so, it's really hard. It's really difficult to do all of this stuff and not be able to be around anybody.
And, you know, cleaning closets and stuff to make them look presentable and everything. So it's just been a lot. Thankfully, I had a very mild case. My smell is already back.
Yeah.
Garrett seems to be, he's been, like, fine today besides a headache. So hopefully his will stay pretty mild. But it's just been a lot. And we were just like, okay, you know, let's give ourselves some grace if we can't get to the podcast as quickly as we would like over the next few weeks, as we're going to be super busy. So, but we're here tonight, and we're happy to be here, and we're semi excited about this chapter. Yeah.
No, it's like we're about to enter into what's long, grueling reading sometimes that you do. So, we'll get into it. We're entering into Exodus chapter 25. And like Melissa mentioned, it's like, this may not be the most intriguing or the most exciting parts of the Bible, but, you know, I want to try to set the stage for it and maybe show how beautiful this would be to somebody hearing it in ancient Israel or whatnot. And I think so what we're about to get into last week, Moses goes up the mountain and he enters into the cloud. He goes into the cloud, and now we're going to start getting God actually giving him the instructions for building his house. They've established this covenant together, and now God is making plans for dwelling among them, which is a theme through the whole book, that God is wanting to dwell among his people. And so we're now getting into the instructions of building his house so that he can dwell among his people. And lest they die, you know, kind of thing, which is what was said as they, you know, would go up the mountain, that, you know, if they came into the presence without the right protocols and without the right, without the right things going on, that, you know, they would end up dying because of the holiness of God. Anyways, so he's setting up, what's going to be the tabernacle and how it is, set up. And so I guess to maybe help with perspective is maybe, like, as we read these things, imagine that you are a child who's grown up in Israel and you've grown up with the temple. You know, the temple has always been there. And every year, a few times a year, you would make the trek to Jerusalem, and you would watch the priests make sacrifices for you. Like, you would take in the sacrifice, they would make the sacrifice, they would go in on your behalf into the temple. But as far as you knew, like, they passed through the temple, and you have no idea what it looks like in there. You've never seen anything in there before, because you're not a priest. You're a child that's been just told, here's what it is that's in there. And so just imagine the awe of it, maybe like you were, as a child, you could only just go to the gates of Disney World, you know, and like all you could see is like, oh, it looks like, you know, they go in there and they do things and then they come out and everybody's happy, you know, you know? Like, or maybe not, they're not happy, but it's just a,
I'm like, pretty sure they are.
Yeah. Well, for Disney World, I guess, but the priests are like covered in blood, you know, and stuff. But anyways, they come out and they make they do all this atonement stuff, and how awesome all of that is, and how in most cases it's a very joyful time to be in Jerusalem. And so anyways, just the think about how this is a place that's like off limits to you, but you know it's powerful. And so whenever you read through this stuff, or somebody, they don't really get to read it themselves a lot, they'll read it in synagogue, where they'll roll out the scroll and they'll hear about it. And so this is them hearing about what is it like in the sanctuary? What is it like in the temple? And so they would hang on these things, and they would, you know, like, listen to these descriptions and be like, oh, this is what it's like to dwell in the presence of God. And so, anyways, I just want to, like, picture that a little bit, maybe to try to draw you in a little bit, as opposed to it just being, like, some architectural layout. It's helping them get a visual of what it's like to be in there, and then also what it tells them about God. Peter N. says this about these sections. He says, both the tabernacle and the articles contained in it weren't meant to be applied personally to the life of the Israelite, as if to say, what does the ark mean to you? They were rather means by which Israel's relationship with God could move to a higher and deeper level. The question for us to ask then is not, what do I do with it, but what does it tell me about God and how he deals with his people? In other words, what is the theology of the tabernacle? And so the question isn't like, oh, you know, how do we apply the temple to our lives?
Which it's is like, what I like to do.
It's something that's very, like, yeah. We want to come to the Bible for, like, life application. But yeah. Sometimes, like, the Bible is telling us about God and what he's like.
Yeah.
And so, I want to really push us more that direction of, like, what is this telling me about Yahweh? What is this telling me about his character, and how he deals with his people? And it's not always life application, you know, and so that's kind of what's going on here. And so this first part just talks about, and Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, and this is going to happen seven times over the chapters 25 through 31. So that's kind of reading it chapter by chapter, even doesn't give us enough to maybe see what this whole thing is doing, in that there's seven speaking engagements that Yahweh has over his tabernacle and the priesthood and everything like that. And the seventh ends with Sabbath. It's a speaking in the Sabbath. And so Peter N. says this. He says that the first six concern the building of the tabernacle and its furnishings, while the final introduces the Sabbath command. It seems clear that the purpose of this arrangement is to aid the reader in making a connection between the building of the tabernacle and the 7 days of creation, both of which involve six creative acts culminating in a seventh day rest. Building the tabernacle is an act of recreation, culminating in the Sabbath command, a new seventh day, as it were. So we're going to, over 25 through 31, we're going to see seven speaking engagements of God. It's a recreation of his world that's here in the midst of Israel. Let's kick this off here.
All right. The Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You are to receive the offering for me from each man whose heart prompts him to give. These are the offerings you are to receive from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and fine linen, goat hair, ram skins, dyed red, and hides of sea cows, acacia wood, olive oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, and onyx stones and other gems to be mounted on the ephod and breastpiece. Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you.
Okay. So, again, we see that first part of Yahweh spoke to Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And he speaks. And he tells him to bring this contribution to him. And I really like this of, like, you will receive my contribution from every man whose heart prompts him. Mm-hmm. It's like this idea of, like, there's not this required giving. It's a giving that's supposed to flow out of the heart of a thankful person. Yeah. Of what they've been given. And what have they been given? Where did they get all this stuff?
Yeah, I know. That was the interesting thing is that was like the first thing I asked. And then I realized, oh, yeah, when they left Egypt,
mm-hmm.
The Egyptians gave them all these things. It was like...
Yeah, gold, you know, and silver and all that stuff.
Yeah, because you kind of think, okay, if you're sort of escaping from slavery, basically, that you and you're just camping out at the base of this mountain, that you probably, it's like, we don't have all this stuff. But it's like, yes, they do.
Right.
They absolutely have it. And they have it because the Egyptians gave it to them freely. And something that I thought about along with that is how the Egyptians, that was their, they were enslaved by them for so long, and that kind of, it felt like there was this separation from God with them. Mm-hmm. And now the Egyptians are what are who gave them the tools that they would need to ultimately be in God's presence.
Yeah. So what we said something like those that were enslaved them, you know, they were actually the ones who gave them the means of making the dwelling of God among them.
Yeah.
And so it's it's amazing that it's like they went from their captors to the ones that actually made it so, you know, well, not necessarily made it so that they could, but they provided the means for which they're going to build the tabernacle out of. I mean, that's an amazing little statement, you know, things that, it's the Esther story of the, Haman makes a tree, he puts a tree up, for Mordecai to be hung on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the, in the Esther story, Haman is found out, and what ends up happening is they say, hey, there's that tree that he put up for Mordecai, and Haman gets hung on the tree.
Yeah.
And so his, what was his means for oppressing and killing Israel was actually their deliverance.
Mm-hmm.
Was their means for deliverance. And so this is kind of that same little theme going on right here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe Esther is, you know, they're playing on each other a little bit.
I do love this, and I will dwell among them.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a beautiful statement, and it is definitely already reminding me of Eden,
mm-hmm.
of God walking with Adam and Eve, how the goal the whole time from the very beginning, from creation, was for God to dwell with us.
That's right.
And so this is kind of, that statement is just setting this up of the whole purpose of these things is so that God can dwell among us.
Right.
And right now in this time in Exodus is, this is how it's being done.
Right. And the stones in here too, play a part in that of linking you, back to Eden, and showing that. And then of course the dwelling in their midst. I mean, that's the theme. That is the thing. That is the theme of the whole Bible. I mean, it is start to finish of that. God dwells with his people in the beginning. They decide to go their own way. And in Revelation, the very ending of the Bible is that God dwells among his people. There's no longer any temple. Why? Because God is their temple. He is the one that's there among them and dwelling in their midst continually forever and ever. And so... this is the theme. This is where he's trying to get to. And so he's saying, I'm going to dwell in their midst, and you're going to make this tabernacle according to the pattern that I show you. And so he's given him some pattern according to his heavenly temple of what's above is going to, what's below is going to replicate what is above. And that it's going to reflect that, and it's going to be part of, you know, in some way his heavenly temple is going to extend down to the earth. The heavens and the earth will meet in this one place, that is the tabernacle. And he says, there I will meet you, and I'm going to dwell in your midst.
So now we're gonna start getting into the pieces, these things that are going to be in the tabernacle. And we haven't really, the scripture hasn't really told us how the tabernacle itself is going to look yet. But
that's
it's starting on the pieces that are inside of the tabernacle.
That's right. Yeah, so we'll kick this off with the Ark of the Covenant. And it says, and they will make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits its length, and 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you will overlay it with pure gold, inside and outside you will overlay it. And you will make on it a gold molding all around. And you will cast for it 4 gold rings, and you will put them on its 4 feet, with 2 rings on its one side and 2 rings on its second side. And you will make poles of acacia wood, and you will overlay them with gold. And you will put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them. In the rings of the ark will be the poles, and they will not be removed from it. And you will put into the ark the testimony that I will give to you. And you will make an atonement cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And you will make 2 cherubim of gold. You will make them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the atonement cover. And make 1 cherub at 1 end and 1 cherub at the other end of the atonement cover. You will make the cherubim on its 2 ends. And the cherubim will be with outspread wings above, covering with their wings over the atonement cover and facing each other. The faces of the cherubim will be toward the atonement cover. And you will put the atonement cover above onto the ark, and into the ark you will put the testimony that I will give you. And I will meet you there, and I will speak with you from over the atonement cover, from between the 2 cherubim that are to be on the ark of the testimony, all that I command you to the Israelites.
So reading this, I'm kind of picturing like a coffin. Not to be morbid, because this is not morbid, but just as like a visual of what this might would look like.
Mm-hmm.
My first thought was like a coffin, like a yeah. a casket, and not like a coffin vampire style. Like I just realized that might sound like that.
Yeah,
but a casket rather, where you have poles for people to carry it or whatever, and then I started realizing what was in it, which is the testimony, which I assume is like the 10 words or the 10 commandments. And I started thinking about something that we have in a box that's very precious to us, and that is our wedding album. Garrett and I have a wedding album that it is in. Well, first off, the album itself is in like this silk bag. And then the silk bag is in this really nice box that like ties with a ribbon or whatever. And the reason it's in such a nice box is because we want it to be well protected. This box was given, like the album came in this box.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it's something that we are always going to cherish.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is very important to us. And it is basically our photo album does a really great job of like showing that whole day.
Yeah.
And what it meant to us.
Right.
And just like we have said in previous chapters of this kind of being the marriage ceremony between the Israelites and God, it's like that photo out that the testimony is obviously way more important than our photo album. But as kind of a comparison or a metaphor, I was just thinking about how this is like reminding me of the commitment that I made to Garrett, you know, 9 years ago,
mm-hmm.
of everything that day meant. And I can just look at that box and be reminded of that, mm-hmm. without even opening it up.
Right.
And, you know, it makes sense to me why then something like the testimony, the words, the commandments would be in such a nice, you know, a box made of gold.
Right.
And I think to build on that even further, you kind of mentioned about how this is God's dwelling place.
Yeah. And so essentially, the ark, I mean, it's mentioned first and foremost because this is the most important piece of everything that's going to be in this tabernacle. Mm-hmm. The Ark of the Covenant. I mean, it's the Ark of the Testimony. That piece is what they've agreed to, and they've said, you know, we're gonna follow all the words that you've said,
mm-hmm.
And it's a reminder of that covenant, and it's also holding them to it. It's saying it's testifying against them or testifying for them, whatever they do. You know, so if they go off and they go against the covenant, then the testimony is there in the meeting place, and it testifies against them that they haven't held up to it. Or if God didn't hold up to his end of the bargain, it's there, you know, but not that he doesn't. It's just a, like, it's this place where this agreement comes to come to a point where it's going to be, it's so that it's holding them to the agreement that they made. But yes, God is going to dwell on this ark. This is his throne. It is the place where he dwells between or above the cherubim. Peter ends writes this, by placing the ark first, the reader's attention is drawn to the central concern of the tabernacle narrative. The ark is the focus of God's presence with his people, the central point of contact between heaven and the tabernacle, the earthly symbol of heaven. The holiness of the ark is no doubt why it is not to be touched. You cannot simply walk up to it and pick it up and move it as you might move a basket of laundry. Rather, a system of rings and poles is necessary to transport it. And as we read in other places, people don't hold up to that holiness and they end up getting struck down upon touching it. Yeah. So one does not simply walk into the Holy of Holies. But anyways, it is God's central dwelling place. It's the place where he's going to meet with them. It's the hot spot of God's presence. And so on that, there's these two cherubim, and you're not really given an explanation as to what the cherubim are. The last time we saw cherubim, it's pointed. The last time we saw cherubim in the story has been actually
Eden.
The Garden of Eden, where the cherubim is set up as a guardian of the Garden of Eden to say, hey, nothing's going to come in here that doesn't belong here. Namely that humanity, who's tarnished creation, they're not going to be able to enter in and take from the tree of life anymore. Now we have the cherubim here. And they're appearing at a place, the place where God dwells. And actually, the Israelites are going to be able to approach this. It's a idea of like entering in, to Eden again. But the cherubim aren't explained as to what they are. You're not given an explanation. It's as if you're supposed to know. These were, Peter ends, these were common symbols in the ancient world. And the Israelites were no doubt familiar with him. Moreover, the sudden reference to these creatures implies that they need no explanation for the Israelite readers. They know about them. Cherubim appear not only over the cover, but throughout the design of the tabernacle, a sign that the tabernacle is a symbolic representation of God's heavenly dwelling. So they're there. The cherubim are there to protect God's throne. They're the soldiers that are staged around a king's throne room. You don't just walk in there. There's guards there that are going to stop you if you're not supposed to be before the king. And so that's what these cherubim are. I mean, they're not plump babies with wings. They're beastly, like monstrosities, with multiple wings and face like lions and bears and, they're like a conglomeration of creation that are there to defend God's throne. They're not to be trifled with. he said that's what's going to be there at the Ark of the Covenant, on top of the Ark of the Covenant. But here's the primary thing that this is all about, which is verse 22, and I will meet you there and I will speak with you. I mean, that's not lightweight. I mean, that's a big deal. I'm going to meet with you at the Ark of the Covenant. This is my way that we're going to come off of this mountain, and you don't have to come to the mountain anymore because I'm going to meet you there.
Yeah.
And so this is all emulating. This is going to start emulating the mountain where they approach the way that they approach God, and they can meet with him the way that Moses is meeting with him now.
Yeah. And just kind of an interesting note with that is that the first section ends with dwelling among you. The mm-hmm. second section is another sort of way of I'm going to be there with you and talk with you. And as we get into this next section, we're going to continue to see that.
Yeah.
So that's just something really cool to highlight, that this is more than just, architect set up.
Right.
That there can be a deeper meaning for us.
Absolutely. I think the more you when you actually experience him, and that's where we don't have the benefit of this. When you actually go in and you experience something on a day to day, you start to understand their meaning.
Yeah.
That's within it. Within doing that thing. So anyways, you want to read this next
section? All right, so we're gonna talk about the table. Make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long, 1 cubit wide, and 1.5 cubits high. Overlay it with pure gold and make a gold molding around it. Also make around it a rim a handbreadth wide and put a gold molding on the rim. Make 4 gold rings for the table and fasten them to the 4 corners where the 4 legs are. The rings are to be close to the rim to hold the poles used for carrying the table. Make the poles of acacia wood, overlay them with gold, and carry the table with them. And make its plates and dishes of pure gold, as well as its pitchers and bowls for the pouring out of offerings. Put the bread of the presence on this table to be before me at all times.
Okay, so if we back up, so the Ark of the Covenant is going to be in what's known as the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place. And then we'll get a description of this later. But there's a dividing curtain, got cherubim on it and everything. And then you enter into the holy place, which is going to, we'll start out with this, which is the table, which is going to be on your right. I think when you go in, table's going to be on your right, and it's that's what's being described here. And on the table, it's covered in gold, acacia wood, just like the Ark of the Covenant was. Both of the, all of these things are made of gold and acacia wood. On the right is the table, and on the table, it's more about like what goes on the table than the table itself. But what goes on the table, seems to be, there's some food and some, which the bread of the presence is there, and, or what would also be known as the showbread or the shewbread. And then there's apparently cups and stuff there too. They would drink wine and eat bread there. And so, you know, there's this idea of having a meal, right? So what are your thoughts on
So immediately, and probably because it was just in the last chapter, mm-hmm. I thought about how Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders came into God's presence, and he didn't destroy them, and instead they ate and drank, mm-hmm. and how they were sharing a meal together. And even last chapter, when we talked about that, we also then pointed forward to Jesus and the Lord's Supper, and kind of talked about how in that moment God is breaking bread with people, and just how that is an intimate moment, a time of celebration. It's supposed to be a happy thing, a good thing. I mean, that's what we do when we have parties, is we usually involve food.
Yeah.
And so seeing that here, it's just, it was just a really cool moment for me to realize that, like, this has always been part of the plan, and God is showing us that theme of, like, how Eden was supposed to be, and,
right.
and how he's going to make it happen again.
Right. And so, just like we're talking about how this is, the tabernacle is emulating what happened on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And on the mountain, they, you know, the elders, the 70 elders and Moses and Aaron and Nadab went up part of the way, right? And they were able to have this covenant meal with God. And mm-hmm. they feast with God. They have a fellowship meal with him, and they commune with him. And so now in the tabernacle, they're going to be having this continually, every day. The priests are going to go in, and they're going to eat the bread, and they're going to drink from these cups that are on the table and whatnot. Like, the priests consume this. And so daily they have this feast and this, this fellowship with God anew every single day. And then every 7 days, they would, on every Sabbath, they would replace the bread of the presence. And then the priests would eat from that, I guess, from the next week. Peter ends again. He says, "This is the second time within a span of 2 chapters that we have seen Israel's leaders partaking in a meal in God's presence. Perhaps the bread of the presence, along with the drink offering implied, are elements in another covenant meal between God and Israel's leaders. The bread and the wine, situated as they are just outside the most holy place, are a continual reminder of the covenant that the holy God, who is located behind the curtain just several feet away, has made with his people. And so it's this continual reminder that we are in fellowship with God. He is dwelling among us, and we're eating with him, you know, and we're having this communion meal with him. And so hopefully that's firing on a lot of things for us, of this communion meal, this continual communion meal with God. You can't help but to land at the Lord's Supper with that.
Yeah.
And how God in the flesh sits down and eats and drinks with his disciples. And how we get to do that, you know, we get to do that every Sunday, you know, together, that we break bread together and do that. So anyways, so that's the table. So the table is going to be on your left, and then on your right, and then on the left is going to be this. And you will make a lampstand of pure gold, and the lampstand will be made of hammered work. Its base and its branch, its cups, its buds, and its blossoms will be from it. And six branches will be going out from its sides, three branches of the lampstand from its one side, and three branches of the lampstand from its second side. Three almond flower cups will be on the one branch with a bud and a blossom, and three almond flower cups will be on the one branch with a bud and a blossom. Likewise for the six branches going out from the lampstand. And on the lampstand will be four almond flower cups with its buds and its blossoms. And a bud will be under the two branches that come from it, and a bud under the two branches that come from it, and a bud under the two branches that come from it. Likewise, for the six branches coming out from the lampstand, their buds and their branches will be from it. All of it, one piece of pure hammered gold work. And you will make its seven lamps, and its lamps will be set up, and it will give light to the space in front of it. And its snuffers and its fire pans will be pure gold. It will be made from a talent of pure gold with all of these pieces of equipment. And see that you make all according to their pattern, which you were shown in the mountain.
So when we first read this, I was thinking, what? I would not want to be the person responsible for this one.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, I need, like, it would be the constant referring back to the instructions of, like, wait, what?
Yeah. It's really hard to read. It's hard to follow and figure out what the heck is going on.
Right. But, like, the only thing that I really recognized immediately was just, again, this garden imagery, Eden imagery of flowers and branches and, you know, this idea of a tree-looking thing. And so I was like, there's something here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's the symbol. It's symbolizing this tree of life.
Yeah.
That you go in and there's this, I mean, it's a tree. Everything about this says that it's a tree.
Yeah.
It's not just a lampstand, it's a tree. It's got blossoms and buds and flower cups, you know, that are coming out from it. It's a tree. G.K. Beale writes this in his, the temple, and the church's mission. He says the arboreal lampstand of Israel's temple was analogous to the portraits of an actual presence of trees in ancient temples that were viewed as cosmic trees, symbolizing the life essence of the entire world. The tree image pointed to the temple as the cosmic center of the universe, at the place where heaven and earth converge, and thus from where God's control over the universe is affected. The metaphorical picture is that of a huge tree atop a cosmic mountain whose height reaches heaven, whose branches encompass the earth, and whose roots sink down into the lowest parts of the earth. This tree was the central life-giving force for the entire creation. So this it's common imagery in the ancient world of having this cosmic tree, but it's essentially, they have to pass by the cherubim to get into this place too. And they pass by the cherubim, and lo and behold, what's there? A tree on their left. And so there's that aspect of it going on. This is they now have access to the tree of life, which is ultimately God's presence. It has nothing to do with a specific actual tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's about seeing God's presence. His holy presence is the only life-giving thing that exists.
Yeah.
Only in God can you find life. And so it's going into this tabernacle, being before the presence of God, and realizing that is what is continually generating life in this world. And the only thing that can sustain life. And so there's that aspect of it going
on. So something that you mentioned to me was, even though we haven't gotten to this point yet in the text of like the curtain and everything, that we have to kind of remember the fact that this is within the tabernacle, and in the tabernacle there's, you know, separate sections and the curtain that separates those sections. And so you asked me the question, you know, when you go behind that curtain, what's it going to be like?
Yeah.
And I thought for a second and I said, dark.
Yeah, you got like this thick curtains. And it's going to be dark unless there's something that gives light.
The lampstand.
And thus there's a lampstand. It is the cosmic tree, but it's also light. It's seven lamps for light in this world, in this new cosmic creation, that God is making, in this structured 7 days, right? In the very first day, what does he create? In his presence, he creates light. And that is in the lampstand. The lampstand is this let there be light moment in the first day. And so, yeah, you go in there and they would maintain the lampstand continually. You know, you don't let the light burn out of the lampstand.
This little light of mine.
Yeah. And then also, there was an aspect of the bread previously that it was going to be continually in his presence, and some aspect of that is developed, I think, with having the lampstand there too. And so what ends up happening is that you've got the lampstand on the left and you've got the table with the bread of presence on the right, and whenever they would replace the bread of the presence in there, essentially the bread of the presence, there were 12 loaves, which represented the 12 tribes of Israel, and they would bask there in the light that came from the lampstand. And the idea of it is that they're continually soaking up this life-giving presence of God. They're able to dwell in and among him. And by dwelling in and among him, they're continually restored and made holy by his light. I think there's a aspect of this whenever John talks about in one of his letters of continually walking in the light and being, you know, continually I'd have to go and look it up, but you know, like there's this aspect of continually dwelling in the light. I think that this John has something of this aspect of the temple on his mind whenever he's talking about it, and that it's like this basking in the light of Jesus, basking in the light of God. And he's continually making us holy, even despite our, you know, our misgivings and the things that we do that are dumb and sinful and all that, that somehow he's still purifying us with his holy light. So this last one I'll do, this is from Michael Morales, from his book, Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord? In Numbers, Yahweh's instructions through Moses for Aaron to arrange the lamps of the candelabra. How do we say that?
Candelabra.
The candle. The lampstand. Lamps of the lampstand.
We're not fancy.
In the holy place. So that they beam their light upon the 12 loaves of bread, representing Israel, on the golden table. This scene portrayed symbolically much the same as the priestly benediction found in Numbers, namely the blessed light of God's face shining upon his people as mediated through the priesthood. Just as the cosmos was created for humanity's Sabbath communion and fellowship with God, so too the cult was established for Israel's Sabbath communion and fellowship with God. Sabbath by Sabbath, the 12 loaves of bread were renewed in the light of the lampstand. This cultic drama symbolizes the idea, or the ideal Sabbath, the 12 tribes of Israel basking in the light of, or basking in the divine light, being renewed in God's presence Sabbath by Sabbath. And so the idea here is that, you know, there, this whole scene is this idea of continually being, you know, being blessed and renewed by God's holy presence.